James Nestor is a science journalist. He got a lot of attention last summer. We spoke to him in August.
How's it going, Doug?
Great. Thanks for agreeing to do this. I didn't know if we'd get you after the Joe Rogan thing.
Nestor writes about oceans and about free diving, but the stir he caused this year with his new book is about breathing. Most of us don't think much about it because it's automatic. But Nestor says breathing is not a passive action. There's a right way and there's a wrong way to breathe. And he first started writing about breathing in his work on free diving. But his interest came before that. It was something that happened to him.
This was several years ago. I was working a pretty stressful job. And I was exercising a lot, eating what I thought were the right foods, and I was sleeping a lot. But I still wasn't really healthy. I kept getting sick. I kept having respiratory problems. I was getting bronchitis, which would turn into mild pneumonia. And this just happened year after year. So I went to my doctor and I said, "What can I do about this?" And she mentioned that a breathing class may help. I found one and looked okay. And I remember walking into this room. There were about a dozen other people sitting around in this circle. So I took a seat in the corner and followed along with this practice, which was just about inhaling at the certain rhythm and exhaling at the certain rhythm. Inhaling at the certain rhythm. Exhaling at the certain rhythm. Inhaling. Exhaling. Inhaling. Exhaling. Inhaling. Exhaling. Inhaling. Exhaling. The more I breathed, the more I started sweating. Within about 10 minutes, I broke into the most intense sweat I've ever had in my life. My hair was sopping wet. My t-shirt was wet. There were sweat stains on my jeans. It was absolutely bizarre. So at the end of the class, I looked at the instructor. "What happened to me?" And she went on about something, prana, chi and energy, and I didn't really understand what she was saying. I didn't take it all in. So I went back to my doctor and I said, "What happened to me?" And she mentioned, "Oh, you obviously had a fever, or the room was too hot, or you were wearing too many clothes." She had no idea what happened to me. She had no scientific understanding of it. I'm a science journalist, and I didn't understand the science of my own experience, didn't understand the science of breathing, and I kind of forgot about this experience until years later, when I was sent on a reporting assignment to write about free divers. These are people who have harnessed the art of breathing specifically to hold their breath for 6, 7, 8 minutes at a time and dive to depths 300, 400 feet. I thought, wow, these people understand this breathing thing more than anyone else. So I was able to really learn so much from them, and that's what really set me off to go out into the field and try to understand the science of breathing.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. James Nestor is with us today. His new book is called Breath. He writes about the science, you know, the physiology of just what is happening in those 3.3 seconds most of us take to inhale and exhale. But there's anthropology in here too, because our ancient ancestors breathed differently than we do for reasons we'll explain. And there's another part about health and mindfulness, because in other cultures, in other times, taking care to breathe slowly was a kind of prayer. But most of us, like 90% of us, just breathe without giving it much thought. And Nestor says we're doing it wrong.
Well, if you look at the data, you've got a quarter of the population suffers from sleep apnea, yeah, which is this nighttime asphyxiation where you go, which is so damaging to the body. About 50% snore, about 10% have asthma, 10% have COPD. And this goes on and on and on. So no one's refuting this data, but no one's really looking at the underlying causes of so many of these problems. And it's attached to breathing habits and our inability to breathe properly. So it's hard to point, like, say, a blanket statement about how specifically we're not breathing properly. We're breathing improperly in myriad ways. Right. Some of us aren't breathing enough. Most of us are breathing way too much and way too often, which is causing so much wear and tear on our bodies.
I guess the reason a lot of people don't think about it is we think about breathing as a passive action. It's just part of this autonomic nervous system. It's going to happen. But it's one of the things you mentioned in the book. That's not right.
Well, it's wonderful that it's an unconscious thing. We don't have to think about it. You know, what a great evolutionary advance that we can go throughout our day and not focus on our breathing. But something amazing happens when we do focus on our breathing. Just like so many of the other systems in the body are unconscious, we can't consciously influence our liver or our stomach or our circulation or our heartbeat. But when we breathe in a certain way, we can influence all of these systems and we can take conscious control of how they operate. And that is such a powerful thing to see people who have been breathing in such an improper way and to take control of this and find that they were able to heal themselves of chronic problems by just fixing their breathing. These sound like crazy claims. But the data is out there. It's very clear in scientific studies. It just seems way too simple to be true for so many people until you check it out, which is what I spent several years doing. Mm.
Let's talk about the evolutionary part that you write about. You mentioned that as we have evolved into the species we are today, that the earlier versions, like the mammals, grew noses, as you say in the book, to warm and purify air, throats to guide the air into the lungs. And this was great. It allowed us to adapt. But the telling of this story is so interesting in the sense that it also involves archaeology, because we have a sense, and anthropology, looking at skulls and comparing them. At one point, as you sort of referring to earlier humans had much more expansive sinus cavities, we had broader mouths, and we had killer teeth. Not killer in that we kill. We had great teeth. We had awesome teeth back then. And we didn't snore. Talk about that. What we were, the construction of the sort of human body at that point.
Sure. We can't go back and put someone in a sleep lab, but we can look at their skeletons and we can look at their nasal apertures and we can look at how their jaws have been formed. And that's what these anthropologists have been doing. And from that data, we can construe pretty safely that these people were not suffering from all of these respiratory ailments that we're suffering from, so much of which is due to the fact that our mouths are too small, that our sinuses are always plugged up. So it's interesting to look at wild animals. You know, when I heard this, I thought, well, God, is this just something that humans used to have? But any wild animal, it doesn't matter if you're looking at monkeys or dolphins or whatever, perfect teeth all the way across, no breathing problems. It is interesting when you get to bulldogs and these brachycephalic dogs that have been bred with this extremely flat face and crooked teeth, guess what?
Yeah.
They snore, they have sleep apnea, they have chronic sinus problems. So humans, modern humans, are essentially just like bulldogs in so many ways. Our faces have been growing so flat, our mouths have been growing so small. And again, this isn't really controversial stuff. Yeah. You can see skulls, the oldest human skull, it's about 300,000 years old. They still have its jaw. And check out the teeth in this jaw. Well, are absolutely stunning. And this is no orthodontics, no Invisalign, none of that stuff. This is how nature made us. And look at any other animal, and you can see that.
When did the shift happen? When did we start to, I'll put it this way, devolve? I'm not sure that's exactly a technical term, but when did the change happen?
The term that Daniel Lieberman at Harvard used, which I really like, is disevolution.
Yeah.
Because evolution is not going to move backwards. It's always going to keep moving, but it can move sideways, which is exactly what's happened to us. So around 300, 400 years ago, we took what had been whole foods and we started processing them. And we started removing the bran and germ from wheat and making this pulverized white flour, bran and germ from rice, white rice. We started canning things. We started putting things in jars. We started baking things, very soft bread. So we started eating food that was so processed that it didn't take much chewing to get it down our throats. Few chews and it was gone. If you think about the food you've even eaten today, even stuff that's considered healthy, avocados, smoothies, you know, goo bars, whatever. Right. All this stuff is soft. And without that masticatory stress, mouths don't develop properly. They grow too small. And we've seen this with, and this chewing has to start in infancy. They've done tons of studies looking at the difference of infants who have been breastfed versus those who have been bottle fed and looked at their incidences of sleep apnea and snoring later on in life. And those who are breastfed, which requires an incredible amount of chewing and stress, which pulls the face out and opens the airway. So it starts with that, and then it works through your youth. If you're just eating, you know, soft TV dinners, taquitos, and all the stuff that I ate growing up, you know, you end up with a mouth that's too small for its face, which is exactly what I have.
I wanted to ask you about mouth breathing. Mm-hmm. Explain what happens when we open our mouths to breathe, like at night, for example. And answer this question, too, because this is something you get at. Why did the human body evolve two channels to breathe through? Because I think most of us think of those as just interchangeable.
I think we evolved this because it's been essential for our survival. If one gets plugged, we can use the other. And what a wonderful thing to have a backup system. But that's exactly what the mouth is. It needs to be considered a backup system to breathing. I'm not saying never breathe through the mouth. You can breathe through the mouth if your nose is plugged. Of course, you're going to do that. But you should not be habitually breathing through the mouth. This is something I had never heard of. I was talking to the chief of rhinology research at Stanford, many interviews with him. We ended up later working on an experiment together. Mm-hmm. And he is a nose guy. So he said there are so many benefits to nasal breathing, and yet 25 to 50% of the modern population habitually breathes through the mouth. So when you habitually breathe through the mouth, especially in youth, you will change the skeletature of your face. You will develop a different face. You will also inhibit your airways, because when you open right now, if you open your mouth, your tongue is going to naturally fall back into your throat, and it's going to help block your airway. When you close your mouth, that tongue is going to naturally rise up to your upper palate and open your airway. So you just imagine what happens when you're sleeping with an open mouth at night. You're forcing the tongue to go back further, and you're loosening the soft tissues in the back of the throat. And you start sounding like that, because when you breathe through the nose, I mean, there's so many other benefits, but I'll just focus on this one right now, is you are pressurizing air. Breathing in, there's a vacuum. breathing out, there's positive pressure that helps tone the airway and make it easier for you to breathe.
Say a little bit more about this experiment. There was a 20-day experiment you did at Stanford. You write a bit about it with another person. And the idea, as I understand it, it is to test this idea that it doesn't really matter which pathway through which we breathe. Like, do it out of your nose, do it out of your mouth. It doesn't matter. And you were going to test this. And it wasn't easy. I have to say that it sounds brutal now that I think about it.
So I had been interviewing everyone I could find, cardiologists, pulmonologists, whomever. And there was this real gap in understanding between them. Some of them said, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
We have evolved a mouth to breathe through it. And many of them are still saying this, where you have these other experts in the field, and these people are at leading institutions saying, we have 50 years of science showing how injurious it is to the body to breathe through the mouth. These people obviously aren't reading about the science, or they don't care about it, or is never part of their curriculum as they were students. But it's very clear that the damage caused by breathing through the mouth is bad news and no one wants it. But nobody knew how quickly this damage came on. By damage, I'm talking about fatigue. I'm talking about sleeplessness. I'm talking about effects to your athletic endurance, on and up respiratory problems. And I was talking to Dr. Jayakar Nayak down at Stanford, and I said, well, you know, would we suffer these problems after a few weeks or a few months or a few years? And he didn't know. No one had ever done an experiment. I said, why don't you do one? You're at Stanford. You're the leader in this field. And in his words, he said, that would be unethical, knowing what he knew about how damaging mouth breathing was.
Wow.
And so I said, well, I'll make it a little easier. I'll volunteer. I'm conscious of some of the damage here, and I'm willingly going to place myself into a position it already knows, because I was mouth breathing a lot growing up. Mm-hmm. I see it in pictures. And that so much of the population already knows, 25 to 50%. So the short version is the study was set up where it was 10 days, only mouth breathing, silicone up our noses. Me and a breathing therapist from Sweden named Anders Olsen showed
up.
Great
character, by the way, I'll just say.
Yeah. Oh, he's such an awesome guy. Yeah. This guy, Stanford had no money for this. There was no money allocated. So we had to pay for it.
Right.
And he paid for his plane ticket from Stockholm to San Francisco for a month because he was so convinced of the power of nasal breathing that he, you know, excuse the pun, but wanted to put his money where his mouth was so right. He could tell his other clients about this. So within the first night of mouth breathing, this is within about 12 hours, my blood pressure went up 20 points. I started snoring that very first night. I had not been snoring before. I snored about an hour and a half first night. Within about 3 days, I was snoring 4 hours throughout the night. I was choking on myself with sleep apnea. We recorded all of this, and you hear this just by changing the pathway through which we were breathing. So we felt awful. We were fatigued. We were running to the bathroom all of the time because our brains weren't releasing vasopressin, which helps the body store water when it sleeps, because we weren't entering deep sleep because we were up all night tossing and turning. So I still have a little PTSD over it. It was awful. I'll just suffice to say, don't do this at home, anyone.
James Nestor, his new book is Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the science journalist James Nestor talking about his new book on the science and art of taking a breath. The science is about what happens when we breathe, how we should be doing it through our noses, not our mouths, and why we're getting it wrong these days. But the art of breathing is about the techniques and the ideas he explored that have been around for hundreds, sometimes thousands of years. His book is called Breath. One of the great parts of the book is
what you learned from ancient texts or really old texts and what people were saying about breathing. You mentioned in the book, for example, the ancient Chinese had this word, this term for the breath inhaled through the mouth. It was called Nichi, adverse breath. And then you say all these other ancient texts. One, for example, I think 1500 BCE, you mentioned one of the oldest medical texts discovered. That's about the nostrils and how they should work in the body. And then there's the Bible, and then there's these Taoist texts. Talk a little bit about what they were saying so long ago about that.
They'd all come to the same conclusions in slightly different ways, which luckily I'm in San Francisco and I'm very close to UCSF, who has this amazing medical library, I'm very close to Stanford as well. So I just spent, you know, months in these libraries digging up these ancient texts and finding that there was really no debate or mystery about breathing throughout various cultures. It wasn't just the Hindus. It wasn't just the Chinese. It was the Greeks. It was the early Christians. And it was the Hebrews. And it was the Native Americans. And they weren't talking to one another, but they all came to these same conclusions. And it was that mouth breathing is bad and nasal breathing is very good. And they can say that in various ways, but that's the nut of it. In the Chinese Tao, you know, they have six books dedicated to breathing, just about breathing. And they call mouth breathing Ni Qi. They say, never do this. It's very clear. It's not like do it on occasion, have fun. Never do this or you will suffer. And I think that's a great message for nowadays. Good for a billboard.
Yeah. Say more about the Native American part about it, because this was really fascinating. There's this artist and character named George Catlin, who does this exhaustive survey of the country's indigenous people. And he starts to notice things about them, and he starts to realize the secret to their great physical prowess is their breathing. Talk about that.
This was another one of those sort of outsiders that wasn't a pulmonologist or wasn't a medical researcher who, again, kept finding the same things. So he was a painter. He painted miniature portraits of renowned people in Philadelphia and finally got sick of doing that. And so in his 30s, he packed up a tent and a gun and some canvases and paints and headed out and covered more miles than Lewis and Clark. And he lived with 50 different Native American tribes. And this was starting in around the 1830s. And it's important to note that this was before these tribes had tobacco, guns, alcohol, any influence from the West, right? He was the first person to live with them. So all these preconceived notions of what we know about these tribes, most of those were taken from notes from people who had come after Catlin, after they had already been corrupted in so many ways. So by living with these cultures, he was able to really understand them. And as he was painting them, and his paintings are in the Smithsonian, very, very well-known guy, he was taking tons of notes, and he was taking notes on their health habits. And he found that breathing to them was an essential medicine. And they were habitual nasal breathers, so much so that mothers would stand over infants in a crib, and if ever they opened their mouths, they would softly close their lips together. After they were done breastfeeding, they would softly close their lips so that this would become a habit. And it's no coincidence to many modern researchers that if you look at early Native American paintings or pictures, these people have these extremely powerful jaws, these forward-growing faces. They had straight teeth. and Catlin wondered if he's like, oh, maybe this is just a Native American thing. So in his 50s, and this was pretty rare to do this in the 1800s, he took a banana boat down to South America and lived with tribes down there. The same exact ancient wisdom of breathing that he said, it's as unchangeable and as old as the hills in these cultures.
This was before we leave the idea of breathing through the nose and the importance, we have to talk about the role the interior of the nose plays in sexual function. And here's the clincher line, James Nestor, from your book. Noses get erections. Talk about this part. I had no idea.
Yeah, this is the weird stuff you start digging up when you start looking into hanging out with too many rhinologists. Right. So I learned that beyond the other functions of the nose, so first of all, I should identify the nose heats up air, pressurizes air. We already know that.
Yeah.
It removes pathogens and it conditions air. So by the time that air gets to the lungs, the lungs can much more easily absorb that oxygen. So much more efficient to breathe through the nose. You get 20% more oxygen per breath than through the mouth. So if that's not going to convince you to do that, I've got something else that just might. So the nose, you like how I just sort of worked that in?
Yeah, yeah.
So the nose, each of our nostrils are covered with erectile tissue. And this is the same erectile tissue as you know where. And it works in the same way. So it engorges with blood and becomes firm, and it blocks off one nostril or the other. It inhibits airflow. So throughout the day, without any conscious control, one side of your nose is going to open up as the other gently closes. Then after about 30 minutes to 3 or 4 hours, the other side is going to open up as the other closes. So a lot of people were wondering, they're like, why would our bodies possibly do this? And just to be clear, no one knows exactly why. There are many theories. And one of them that I find to be pretty convincing is when we breathe through separate nostrils, if you right now hold your left nostril shut and breathe through your right, you are going to be increasing circulation. You're going to be heating the body up. You're going to be increasing heart rate. This is more associated with a sympathetic or stimulating effect. When you breathe through the left nostril, you can hold that right closed and breathe through it. You're going to be cooling the body down. Blood pressure is going to lower. Blood is going to slow. You can help reduce anxiety. You're going to calm yourself down. So the fact that there's yoga practices. I'm sure many listeners are familiar with these called alternate nostril breathing or Nadi Shodhana, where you can hack this. You can calm yourself, breathe through the left. You can create balance by breathing through both of them. But our noses naturally do this throughout the day, and they do it our entire lives. And there's something beautiful about that, that our noses are alternate nostril breathing just on their own without any help from us. We get none of these benefits if we're breathing through our mouth.
Let's talk about the importance of exhaling. This is another thing I hadn't realized. You mentioned how full exhalations, for example, are seldom practiced. Why is that? What's the thing we're thinking about exhalation?
I think some of it has to do with posture. Some of it has to do with stress. And some of it has to do with just the fact that we're not aware of how powerful it is to really engage the diaphragm. Yeah. So underneath the lungs, the lungs don't inflate themselves. So there's this muscle, it's shaped like a parachute, and it is right underneath the lungs. And when you take a deep breath in, that parachute, that diaphragm sinks down and allows the lungs to inflate. When you exhale, that diaphragm moves up and pushes air from the lungs. What they've found is that so many of us are using only partial movement of our diaphragms, you know, 10 to 20%. So we're just breathing into our chest. So if you're sitting down at a desk right now, you're probably slumped over like I usually am. And when you're slumped that way, it is much harder to get air down into the deeper lobes of the lungs. So we just learned to breathe way more breaths, way too many breaths, higher into the chest. We can still get oxygen this way, but it is completely overburdening our bodies. So by just engaging the diaphragm, especially that exhale, because a lot of people, you say, hey, take a deep breath. They go, and they just put air on top of air. If you want to take a really enriching deep breath, get that stale air out, you first have to exhale. So if anyone's going to tell you to take a deep breath, say, sure. But exhale first. And that diaphragmatic movement, I was just talking to a doctor about this a couple of days ago, and this blew my mind. So it's not only great for the lungs to bring more air in and more air out, to allow us to get more with less, but the diaphragmatic movement also massages the organs right down there near our stomach and allows them to offload more lymph fluid. So this is how the body is able to get rid of toxins, this diaphragmatic movement. And if we're not engaging it, all of that lymph fluid can just stay there and coagulate, which can then cause so many problems down the road.
Mm. You know, one of the ways I was reading your book is I was listening to the audio version of it in part. And I was walking in the foothills here in Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. And as I was doing it, I noticed myself trying some of these techniques as I'm, you know, going up a hill. Like, I'm going to just try to breathe from my nose, or I'm just going to try to breathe more slowly. And I was surprised at how panicked I felt at first with that. Did you have that same kind of experience? And maybe you could talk about one of the sections of the books where you talk about the importance of breathing slowly, because it seems counterintuitive, and I felt really panicky for a minute.
Absolutely. I had those experiences over and over again, and most people will, just a heads up, because once you've been breathing in a certain way for years or even decades, your body isn't used to this switch in breathing, right? And the thing that stimulates breathing is not oxygen. It's never a lack of oxygen unless you're up very high in elevation. It is carbon dioxide. So right now, if we all hold our breath, exhale, and hold your breath, after about 15 or 30 seconds, you're going to feel this need to breathe. That is from the buildup of carbon dioxide. So many of us have this very low threshold of CO2 that when it starts rising up just a little bit, we go, because one of our greatest fears is to be denied the ability to breathe.
Yeah.
And so what we found is that, and the researchers, Justin Feinstein at Laurier Institute of Brain Research, is doing so much work in this area. It's fascinating. But populations who have chronic asthma, chronic anxiety, they will traditionally have an extremely low threshold of CO2, because whenever they feel that need to breathe, they associate that with an attack. And guess what happens? They start breathing more. Oh God, here comes a, and what happens? And so the more they breathe, the worse the attack is going to get, because the more CO2 they're going to be offloading. That's a little technical, but this is known stuff. And the numbers and the science is very clear. So what they're doing, one of the reasons why training someone to breathe more slowly and to breathe less, which is way more efficient for oxygenation, for heart, your heart, for all the systems of the body, is by allowing them that higher threshold of CO2, they can be calmer. And that's why these you can call it different things, Papworth, Buteyko, slow and less breathing can have a profound effect on both asthma and anxiety.
I loved this too. You say in the book that slow breathing in other cultures and in other times goes by another name, prayer.
So they did some studies, some Italian researchers, about 20 years ago, and they noticed that they recorded people with all of these sensors to their body, and they had them recite the Latin version of the rosary. So the rosary was actually taken from Arabs, brought it to Europe. And the Arabs took it from Tibetan monks. So that's a well-known history. And they compared the Catholic rosary to Om Mani Padme Hum, which is one of the most famous Buddhist mantras. And they found that when you recite each of these, it takes about 5 to 6 seconds to recite this, to vocalize it. When you're vocalizing, you are exhaling. Then you have about 5 to 6 seconds to inhale. So when they looked at what happens to the body when you breathe at this rate, you can use these prayers if you like, but you don't need to. You can just breathe at this rate. You increase oxygenation to the brain, your heart rate slows down, and all of your systems, your cardiorespiratory systems, enter the state of what they called coherence, where everything is working at peak efficiency. You're getting maximum oxygen for minimal effort. And just by breathing this way, I have borderline higher blood pressure. After 2 minutes of breathing this way, I can see a decrease of about 10 to 15 or even more points in blood pressure. And this is the same with other people. And what that is, this isn't a placebo effect. This is your body operating at peak efficiency. And when you allow it to do more for less effort, you can also allow it to help heal itself.
This idea that we can get longer lives, or even that our lung capacity can be restored, is something that you write about. And there are a number of characters here. Katarina Schroth, is that how she pronounces that name?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe talk about her too. Here's another great character.
So we've been told that whatever organs we've gotten, especially in adulthood, is what we're stuck with.
Yeah.
So for several decades, we were told that you could not develop the diaphragm. It was impossible. We're also told that you could not develop lung size. You couldn't affect it. You couldn't affect lung capacity. All of that is totally false. So someone who I found that demonstrated this most clearly in the most staggering way was Katarina Schroth. She was a teenager living in Dresden, Germany in the early 1900s, and she had scoliosis. So she was given a brace, you know, a wheelchair, and said, there, you can live there the rest of your life. But she had other thoughts about the human body's potential. And so she developed something called orthopedic breathing, where she would stretch in a position and breathe into one lung, and then stretch in another position and breathe into the other lung. And she breathed her spine straight again. And even more miraculously, she went to treat women for whom no other therapy worked, who had changes in their spine, in their skeletature, of about 80 degrees. So these were the most severe people who were just left in bed to just wither away. She brought them to this farm and helped them straighten their spines with breathing. There are x-rays of what Schroth has done. She was derided. They tried to shut her down numerous times. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of her life, it's funny how people tend to come around. The German government awarded her a very prestigious medal for her contributions to medicine. She lived to be 90 years old. So just shows you, yeah, we're messed up. Our faces are messed up. A lot of us have messed up lungs. But through the power of will, we can use our body to heal itself. We can do so much of that with proper breathing.
Carl Stau.
Carl Stau was another one of the, I call these people pulmonauts. Yep. So these outsiders who just came to breathing randomly. He was a vocal teacher. He was a choral conductor. And he found a lot of his singers would just like pack air on top of air. And they'd sing in a certain way. He thought, well, all vocalization is on the exhalation. So if I could get them to exhale better, they could sing better, which is exactly what he did. He became so renowned that he started working with Met opera singers who could already sing pretty well, but he helped them sing even better. After doing this for years, he was asked by the VA hospitals on the East Coast to help emphysemics who had essentially lost all control of their diaphragms. And, you know, they'd given these people oxygen, antibiotics, and they had literally been left there to die. They had no idea how to treat them. Stau went in, showed them diaphragmatic movement, showed them how to breathe. That's the only therapy he used, was breathing. And these people who had been left for dead walked out of the hospital. There are x-rays, there's data. He was there for 10 years, and the top pulmonologist confirmed what he did was supposed to have been impossible, and yet he kept doing it over and over again and healing these people with breath.
Stau is such a fascinating character, I have to say. And the thing that's kind of tragic about his story, as you mentioned, and this seems like the case with a number of the pulmonauts that you write about, is that because they weren't doctors or weren't pulmonologists, mm-hmm. they just weren't taken seriously. The scene is too far out there. This is just too woo, woo, woo. It's just too weird. And no one was paying attention.
That's true by the larger medical community. But what was so interesting with both Schroth and Stau is If the German medical community is awarding her a medal for her contributions, obviously what she was doing wasn't woo-woo. It wasn't new age. It was proven. The head pulmonologists at these hospitals confirm what Staub was doing absolutely worked. Mm. But it was so weird. If you ever saw his therapy, it looked like some sort of sorcery. You know, he'd have these people recite 1 to 10 over and over as he massaged their chest. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 9, 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And so it almost sounded like some occultist chant. But what he was doing was allowing them to vocalize to help build those muscles as they exhaled. And it worked so well that he went on to train the 1968 men's track and field team for the Mexico City Olympics, because the elevation was like 6,000, 7,000 feet there. These guys went down, destroyed everybody. I think it's still the greatest track performance ever in Olympics history. And then they didn't need oxygen before or after the race because they knew how to breathe properly.
One of the sections of the book is what you describe as the idea of breathe more on occasion. And that gets us to one of the most fascinating characters there is, although you don't spend a lot of time with him because other people have, Wim Hof, and people will know who he is. Talk a little bit about Wim Hof and some of his, how he comes to this breathing technique. He's not alone in doing this, but he's one of the more interesting ones.
So I set up the book in the way that the beginning of it is, you know, kind of the problem. We have to acknowledge the problem. Then most of it, the middle of it, is this foundation that anyone can benefit from these things. Nasal breathing, full exhalations, breathing less, breathing slowly. So anyway, it doesn't matter if you're an athlete, asthmatic, emphysemic, you're going to benefit from that. But at the end of it, you know, there's some of these breathing techniques that require more effort. It's pretty easy to breathe at a rate of about 5 to 6 seconds in, 5 to 6 seconds out. But it's a little harder to spend 20 minutes just breathing as fast as you can, you know, and sweating and clenching your fist. So I called that section Breathing Plus because it requires more time and effort, but the benefits of it are profound. So Wim Hof is someone who did not invent this method, and I've been in contact with him, and he's very clear about this.
Yeah.
He adapted a method that had been around for thousands of years, and it's called TUMO. And what TUMO is you consciously put yourself in a stress state. And people are like, why the heck? I'm so stressed throughout the day. The last thing I want to do is come home and be stressed. But the reason is so many of us suffer from this chronic low-grade stress where we're half awake during the sleeping hours, and we're half asleep during our waking hours. We're never really relaxed. We're never really stressed. But the human body is built to either be on or off. So if you think about how we evolved, we're running after a mammoth. We're fighting for our lives. And then we sit around for 18 hours and eat and sleep. So this stress called hermetic stress is being studied at University of California, San Francisco, right down the road from me. And Hof has been teaching this for 15 years. And what he is doing is supposed to be scientifically impossible. So by breathing in certain ways, he can heat his body up. He can sit in an ice bath for 2 hours, not have his core temperature go down, not have frostbite, not have hypothermia or any other problems. He can get up, have a cup of coffee, and move on. And he's not special. The monks have been doing this for thousands of years. Yeah. Herbert Benson in the 80s at Harvard went and found them and put sensors on them and showed that this is 100% how the body can work if we let it. So by spiking your stress throughout the day, you're allowing the systems of the body to calm down. It's almost like a pressure release valve. And we can also use this to help fight off pathogens. They injected Wim Hof with E. coli, which for the rest of us would make us extremely sick and feverish and clammy and shaky. No problem. And they thought he was just a freak of nature. It's funny if you read these reports when they did this, what, 8 years ago. They said, oh, you're just a weirdo. No one can do this. He said, oh, yeah? Give me some patients, some control study. And they set that up, and he took 10 patients versus 10 controls. And I should call them subjects, not patients. He's not a doctor. But he led them through his workshop about 4 days. They came back, were able to do the exact same thing. So by using breathing, breathing can be this lever to turn stress on, or most importantly, to turn it off. And the reason why this hermetic stress has been so widely studied now is because it can have a profound effect for people with autoimmune problems, people with arthritis, chronic inflammation, psoriasis, eczema. And I've talked to several of these people. Nothing else worked for them, but they breathed in certain ways. They exposed themselves to cold on occasion, and they no longer have symptoms to problems that they've had for decades. And there are thousands of these people out there.
You do mention there's an app now, and maybe others, and that before long you wonder if breathing is going to be big business. So it does say a few things. One, that it's going to get exploited for monetary gain on one hand. But that's something you also mentioned, by the way, is that you don't have to spend a lot of money to learn this stuff. In fact, it's something that you were pretty adamant about, it seems like, in the book.
Well, it's, you know, to ask someone to change their health by adopting a keto diet or a paleo diet, it's asking a lot of someone by asking them to go out and run 3 miles a day. That's asking a lot, but breathing is with us all the time, and it's free to breathe. These practices are readily available. They're free. I put a bunch of them on my website. Yep. All the scientific references are on the website. They're conducted by experts, by doctors in the field, and it really doesn't take that much effort.
And a little bit of athletic tape is pretty cheap too. Talk about how you sleep at night.
What this is to place a teeny piece of tape. I'm not talking about a fat strip of duct tape, like hostage situation stuff. All you need is a teeny piece of surgical tape, which has this really light adhesive. And the point is just to train your mouth shut at night. It's not to inhibit airflow or inhibit. You can even talk when you have this stuff on. It's just to gently train the mouth shut so that you spend a third of your day breathing through your nose. And the benefits of that, as I've gone over quite a bit during the show, are profound. And you can see for yourself, I'm receiving hundreds of emails from people saying, oh my God, I'm no longer snoring. I no longer have mild or moderate sleep apnea. And this has been going on for a long time. This isn't something I invented. It's something I picked up from experts in the field who have really studied it.
You talk about breathing like stretching, I guess. And maybe finally, what's the perfect breath?
It depends on what you're doing. So the perfect breath jogging is going to be different than the perfect breath at rest. But overall, the perfect breath should be to breathe as closely in line with your metabolic needs as possible. And for the vast majority of us, that will be to breathe slower and to breathe less. So at rest, while I'm sitting here, I mean, we've been talking a lot, so I'm breathing through my mouth. I'm not been breathing in this paced, focused way. But if I were sitting here on my couch, I would try to breathe at a rate of about 5 to 6 seconds. I say 5.5 in the book, and then people have written saying, what's wrong when I'm a half a second off? And I thought, oh my God, what have I done here? So 5 to 6, even 4 to 7 seconds. Let's spread that out a bit. In 4 to 7 seconds. Out, that even breath. You can even place your hand over your heart and you can feel it slowing down. You can feel your blood pressure lessening. So if you want to go to sleep or get more relaxed, you just extend the exhale. When you do that, you are stimulating a parasympathetic response in your body, and you can help yourself better relax. Different levers of breathing can do so many different things. And that's one I try to practice as often as I can, about 5 to 6 seconds in, 5 to 6 seconds out. The science is very clear on that as well. Dr. Patricia Gerbarg and Dr. Richard Brown have been studying this stuff for decades, and they found it's very effective for people with anxiety, depression, I mean, on and on and on, because you're allowing your body to do what it naturally wants to do.
James Nestor, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
James Nestor, his book is called Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. We spoke with him in August. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.